This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Barron's Live, how to understand and invest in today's market. I'm Beverly Goodman, Editorial Director of Investing and Asset Management at Barron's. Joining us today is my colleague, Associate Editor, and Up and Down Wall Street columnist, Randy Forsythe. Welcome, Randy.
That's okay. Thanks very much.
Okay, so thank you so much for being here. I was saying how excited I am for this conversation, since even though Barron's is filled with tons of really smart people, there are few people whose opinions on the markets and the economy I respect more than yours. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's start with where we are today, looking at stocks. We'll get to the bond market in a moment, but starting with stocks, their stock prices are high. You say unsustainably so. What are you seeing? What concerns you?
Well, the main thing is that we've gotten a lot of good news, and I think all the good news is reflected in the bond market. In the stock market. Also, we'll get to the bond market later. But everybody knows that we're having a big recovery. I think it's best characterized as a bungee jump from last year's big plunge, that the earnings for the latest earnings season have come in very strong. The percentage gains will be even bigger in the second quarter, but the stock market looks ahead and has sussed that out already and has priced that in. So the S&P 500 is up 80-something percent from the lows last year. So the big improvement in the economy that's apparent to everyone is reflected. And by the way, a lot of the first quarter earnings, which were spectacular, elicited practically no response from stock prices in many cases. And that's because, again, the stock market looked ahead pretty much from the early November announcement of the first Pfizer vaccine. That was the clue that we were going to recover. The recovery is happening just as expected. But as I say, the stock market looks ahead. And after the bungee jump, we are going to say flatten out or rise at a much slower trajectory in terms of economic growth and earnings growth. So that's already in the market. And that's also been largely the product of just unprecedented fiscal and monetary stimulus. The only thing you can liken to what we've gone through in the last year in terms of fiscal policy is something like a wartime effort, where the government spends without regard, because it has a clear and present danger to address. And things like how to pay for it, is something for the future. And that's absolutely proper. What we're getting now is the payoff from that. And a lot of money that's spent, first of all, kept food on the table and prevented people from being evicted, which is absolutely the proper response. But also there's an excess of savings in many cases. And also with interest rates being driven to record lows by the Federal Reserve's policies, there's a lot of money being spent. And it's no news that about the boom in people moving to houses in the suburbs, and there aren't enough single-family homes for everybody who wanted to move. So there's a housing boom. And those bubbles always tend to end badly. And when you move, as a suburbanite, I can tell you, when you move out of the city, you need a lot of stuff, especially first of all, you need a car, which is an unnecessary appendage in the city. And then you need all the stuff like from Home Depot and Lowe's for around the house. And the stocks of those big box home retailers have reflected that. You also probably need another new TV, need furniture, and so forth. And all those things are in appliances are in terribly short supply, waiting times. So all of these things, it's like this, you know, the old pig and the python analogy. Things are all moving through the system slowly, but all of those things I see as being reflected in current near record stock prices.
I want to ask you just quickly about something you mentioned. You referred to an excess of savings. What does that mean, and why is that a problem?
Well, a lot of people, when they got stimulus checks, they didn't spend it all right away for whatever reason. Some people who didn't need the money still got a check from the government. Also, if you're not going to restaurants, you're not traveling anywhere, you're not doing all these other things, and you're just sitting at home streaming Tiger King or stuff like that, you're simply not spending as much money. And you certainly don't get dressed up to do that. So clothing sales were slow. So all these things that people used to spend their money on that and they couldn't, it built up in their savings account. And some of it has to go somewhere. And one of the places it's gone into is the stock and the bond market.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the bond market. What is that telling you?
Well, the bond market also saw the huge recovery coming, which and a stronger economy and probably higher inflation means higher bond yields and lower bond prices. In the first quarter of the year, we had the worst bond market in 40 years, probably in history, in terms of price declines. The benchmark 10-year note went from under 1% to about 1.75%. To a normal person, that doesn't sound like much, but to a bond person, that's a huge move. And since you're not getting much in the way of interest, those price declines were pretty severe, and you had a very negative total return. What's been very interesting is about 2 months ago, the bond yield stopped going up. And when everybody saw this boom going on all around them and higher inflation numbers and the Federal Reserve saying, yes, we want inflation to go higher, all of that should be bad for the bond market in terms of prices and higher yields. But since a couple of months ago, the bond market is mysteriously stabilized in a narrow band between about 170% and 155%, around where we're hovering now on the 10-year note. That tells me that after the inflationary boom we've experienced so far, that looking ahead, that things are going to be a lot quieter, and which is good for stocks in one sense, that higher interest rates are bad for a lot of big tech stocks. But on the other hand, that the economic boom could be, well, not petering out, but we'll go back to our old cruising speed of around 2% as opposed to the boom that we're experiencing at the present time. So markets look ahead. We know everything is hot now, but I think the bond market is saying that things are going to cool off, and that means that it's going to be harder to find big broad winners in the stock market.
So broadly speaking, though, is that a problem? I mean, isn't this cooling off period something that's necessary? You're not predicting a big crash or a bear market of any kind, right?
Well, one of my favorite analogies is if when you get on a roller coaster, you get off at the same place you started. So that's net flat. So it used to be that 10% corrections were any time during the year were pretty normal occurrences. That seems to upset people a lot now, this kind of normal swings. So we could. I'm very surprised we haven't had something like that, some kind of correction. For some reason, it tends to happen during the summer and the late summer. And I would point to a lot of people are looking to the Fed, as I do, for clues, because the very cheap money and voluminous money created by the Fed is a major reason for very high stock prices and very low bond yields. And there is, so right now, the Fed is pumping $120 billion into the economy every single month through its security purchases. Mm-hmm. Even with unemployment way down, the big problem is there aren't enough workers for the job openings. And there is great expectation that sometime in the summer, as the Fed chair Jay Powell puts it, they will start thinking about reducing that rate of purchases. I would suggest that given the super hot and inflated housing market, they are now purchasing $40 billion of mortgage-backed securities every month, which is essentially a subsidy for the housing market, the strongest part of the economy. So that should be throttled back. Now, the reason I belabor this point was in 2013, the last time the Fed tapered their bond purchases, the market had, I guess the technical term for it would be a conniption. That
the taper tantrum. Yeah.
Yes, the taper tantrum. And bond yields moved up, stock market hit an air pocket, but pretty much recovered. And the Fed is very chastened by that experience. And they want, instead of having, that kind of air pocket reaction, they want to have, a nice smooth glide path. Mm-hmm. Whether that's possible, I don't know. But this is widely anticipated, and there ought to be some kind of reaction in the markets. And my point is that I like to buy things when they go on sale. I don't like to buy things when they're fully priced. So I think there'll be better buying opportunities ahead instead of plunging ahead into the markets right now, both for stocks and bonds.
So we have a couple of listener questions, and I want to remind folks that you're still free to ask questions in the Q&A. Or in the Q&A box, I should say. Sticking with fiscal policy, we have a question about a comparison to what's happening now versus the stimulus we saw in 2008. How would you compare the two? What did we learn from 2008?
What we've learned from 2008 was the seemingly unimaginably massive, like $800 billion fiscal package was way too small then. Mm-hmm. And it was fiscal policy was tightened fairly sharply with things like sequesters and the threatened government shutdowns and so forth. That was the lesson, was that when you have a crisis, you should go big. Since then, we've had the CARES Act and then
Secure Act.
Yes, and then this year's act, I've forgotten all the acronyms, but it's totaled in the trillions. And also, I would note that before the pandemic, we were the U.S. government was running a fiscal deficit of almost $1 trillion with full employment, which is when they should be almost in balance, which was close to 5% of the size of the total economy. That is almost a crisis budget when everything it was as good as it could get, for real. And now, after that, we've essentially, when a crisis comes, then you have to spend. And now our debt level has been built up to such an extent, the federal government's official debt is bigger than the U.S. economy, a debt to GDP ratio of over 100%. And at some point, that will become a drag. Now, we're getting away with this for one reason and one reason only. Interest rates are so low, courtesy of the Fed. The Fed buys Treasury securities, and that keeps the yields low and the price is high, so Uncle Sam can borrow very cheaply. Mm-hmm. Eventually, this historically has caused inflation. The other reason we get away with that is that the U.S. government's IOUs are the rest of the world's favorite liquid asset. Right now, other countries, other central banks, other monetary authorities have been gradually reducing their holdings of U.S. treasuries. That's fine for now because the Fed is buying so much, because banks who are flush with deposits that more than they can loan out are buying those treasuries. So right now, it's plenty easy for the federal government to borrow as much as it wants at historically cheap levels. Eventually, this catches up with you. So that's my worry in the future. That's, you know, really could come to head, you know, sometime around 2030. Mm-hmm. And later in this decade, what is inevitable is all of us boomers will be getting even older, drawing more on Social Security and Medicare. And there is an inevitable fiscal day of reckoning. Mm-hmm. That's something past 2025 into 2028. That's what I would worry about, but that's a very long-term worry, obviously.
Yeah, so bringing it a little bit closer in on the timeline, mm-hmm. you know, this week's Barron's cover story obviously was the shortage of everything. I think mm-hmm. that's what you were sort of likening to this, like the python trying to yes. digest the pig, I think you said.
in a more serious way, a lot of this fiscal and monetary stimulus has brought a lot of demand forward. And the supply chains can only satisfy that demand as fast as lumber can be produced, as fast as it can be shipped, and as fast as refrigerators can be made. Mm-hmm. Eventually, it will catch up. Remember how a year ago we were scrambling for toilet paper and hand sanitizer?
Yes.
It's serious. Now there's a surfeit of those things. Eventually, supply will catch up with demand. In the meantime, there'll be a shortage of everything. There'll be upward price pressure. There'll be people who will say, I don't care, I need a new fridge. And they'll pay the higher price. And there'll be some people saying, okay, I can wait for, you know, a new dryer. I'll hang it on the clothesline or something in the meantime. Or I'll wait to get a new car or a used car until the waiting lists are shorter.
Mm-hmm. So how does this sort of threat of near-term inflation paired with the potential for a cooling economy, how does all this play out in the next, you know, couple of years maybe, or whatever time frame is most appropriate?
I'd love to know. I'm waiting to see how it turns out. There are two ways it can play out. Number one, and the most likely thing, there will be a limit to how high the prices that people are willing or able to pay. You're already seeing this in house prices, that mortgage applications are declining because at some point, people who want to buy a house will no longer qualify for financing. You know, if house prices go up 20%, I mean, that means they have to come up with a bigger down payment, not to, even with ultra low mortgage rates. Or they'll say, you know, this is just nuts. And I'll rent for a couple of years and I'll come back then. The other aspect is what do corporations do? Now, the latest purchasing manager survey shows record high input costs. Now, do they absorb some of it, or how much of it can they pass along? So some of it may be in higher prices, the other might be in slimmer profit margins. How that plays out, I think it'll probably be a little of both. And that means slower profits growth and less purchasing power for consumers.
So I want to get to some practical things that investors should be thinking about. But first, I want to take one listener question who's asking, aren't traditional models of inflation outdated given technology's impact on productivity?
That it just to some extent that's true. And I would say that would hold for a lot of things, but not everything. You can technology. Where we've had the lowest inflation are things that can be mass produced and imported. You can't import houses, and you can't totally mechanize carpenters and plumbers. I mean, they don't wield, you know, just hand hammers. They have air guns to hammer the nails, but there is a limit. But I think there's a very good point there. One example that I like to cite is that I think with fast food restaurants having to pay a $15 minimum wage in many cases, the incentive to mechanize part of that job is much greater than when they were paying 7.25. So you'll probably be ordering more hamburgers and such from a little kiosk like an ATM rather than a human clerk who would have to be paid $15. So there is some offset. But in terms of things, now the number one, I keep coming back to housing, in the Consumer Price Index, housing is by far the biggest portion. And again, technology has a very limited impact on that.
Okay, so we're gonna, I know you've got some ideas what investors should do. One more question before we get there. I wanted to ask you this, and it's also a listener question. I know you've got a great answer for this. We're 1 week into June. We have to know the old adage, sell in May and go away. What are your thoughts on that? Tell us the history of it. I know
the history of that was better, say before the 21st century, and for some reason it goes back to the English aristocracy would take off the summer and they would sail in May and go away until there was some horse racing meet in September, That's a crazy derivation, but there does seem to be a seasonal pattern, and for whatever reason, getting the market tends to top out in at the end of May and early June, and then meanders in the summer, and August and September. Historically, for some reason, that's when crashes have come. I don't get it, but it seems to repeat. And I would say only again, a lot of Fed watchers are looking towards the end of August when they have this big confab in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, when Jay Powell is expected to announce their plans for tapering. That would fit in with the kind of sell in May thing. Mm-hmm. But if anything, I still would possibly want to take profits just to have cash around to go bargain hunting later, because there's relatively few bargains around at the moment.
Should people take profits across the board, or especially among like big tech and some of the other?
Well, yeah, big tech hasn't been doing much since late last year, since we've got the good vaccine news. That was what was going to be. That was almost, ironically, the defensive place to be, because you knew that whatever else happened, you know, Apple is still going to be selling tons of iPhones and services, et cetera. The more cyclical stocks have been extended. Now, I would take profits definitely in the cyclical part. Mm-hmm. And I do eventually expect, as inflation increases and the economy starts, it just steams along and excess capacity is used up, that interest rate, long-term interest rates will get back to around 2% on the 10-year. That should be good for financials, which even though they've acted very well this year, I still think they're about the cheapest sector in the market.
Okay. You are a big fan of closed-end funds. What do you like there?
Okay. I like closed-end funds because I think they're the most inefficient sector of the whole financial markets, because it's ignored by big institutions. These are all they would qualify as small or micro cap stocks. There isn't enough liquidity for institutions. Also, the crazy meme players haven't discovered them either. So they're very income oriented, and you can buy a lot of them at discounts. I'm not going to go into all the mechanics of that. But and a lot of them have recovered very, very strongly from last year when they plunged, along with the rest of the market. If the risk is for higher interest rates, there is one sector that that's relatively immune, and those are ones that invest in short-term floating rate loans. If short-term interest rates go up, and the Fed isn't expected to do this until 2023, their dividends ought to go up. Actually, they borrow at short-term rates, and their loan assets pay that short-term base rate plus 5 or 6 percentage points. In any case, you can get a whole bunch of any number of these, yielding in the 6% range and selling at a discount, and just collect that you know, it's around 6 to 7% interest, which is really boring, but boring is good in a market that can be frothy. So that's my single best idea, and I have to admit that idea was stolen from Jeffrey Gundlach, the bond king of double line. He made it in January his pick for 2021, and so I'm just riding his coattails and his glory in recommending them.
I think that's where we have to leave it. Thank you so much, Randy, for all your insight and specific suggestions. It was great.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Thanks. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. We hope you can join us again tomorrow. MarketWatch retirement reporter Ali Melito and contributor Robert Powell are going to discuss some of the hottest topics with retirement savings, including how prepared Americans are, what they can do to improve their retirement security, and determine whether they'll get Social Security. Thanks for listening. Stay healthy and stay safe, everyone.